This podcast contains adult themes and language. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, I'm Bob Miller, host of The Lawless Files, and you're listening to a special bonus episode of the podcast. In just a minute, we're going to play the recording of an interview I recently did with Tom Beardsley. Just a note that you will be listening to an abbreviated version of this interview on this platform. To listen to the full interview, you'll need to be a paid supporter who has purchased the access pass at www.thelawlessfiles.com. But there is quite a bit here to sink your teeth into. But just a little background first. I talked to Beardsley a couple of years ago when I was in note-taking mode for the book I was hoping to write. So that was before I decided to pivot to a podcast. I didn't record that interview. You've heard me refer to Beardsley before. His initial interview of Mark Abbott was recorded and transcribed, and we have played a reenactment of that interview. Beardsley was the chief deputy under then-Sheriff Bill Farrell at the time of the Michelle Lawless murder. He was the first person called on the night of the murder, he was the first paid deputy to arrive on the scene, and he was the first person to interview Mark Abbott about what he saw when he pulled up to the car. When I interviewed Beardsley a couple of years ago by phone, he told me he was taken off the case before he got the chance to interview Mark Abbott a second time. Furthermore, in that interview, he said he believed Farrell intentionally looked away from Abbott as a suspect in this case. He told me in that phone interview he suspected it had to do with Farrell's relationship to Larry Abbott, Mark and Matt Abbott's father. He cited campaign contributions as a potential reason for Farrell to do a favor. He told me at the time he didn't believe Farrell was on Larry Abbott's payroll, but perhaps it was more of a tit-for-tat kind of favor. As we've demonstrated throughout this podcast, it appears that every effort was made to shield Mark Abbott as a suspect, since he had given so many different accounts of what happened. Abbott's explanations, including descriptions of who he saw at the crime scene, changed many times. Portions of his story didn't even make sense. When pressed on the matter by Josh Keyser's defense attorneys, Bill Farrell could only respond, "I don't know," when asked why Abbott was not polygraphed and why his blood was not drawn. So what you're about to hear is a follow-up interview with Beardsley about his role, or lack thereof, in the investigation of Michelle Lawless's murder. I'm your host, Bob Miller. You're listening to The Lawless Files.
When you were assigned as an investigator, was Mark Abbott a suspect in this killing?
No, sir, not at any time.
Neither Mark Abbott nor Matt Abbott were vampired or printed. Why was that not done?
I don't know. I don't know that they weren't. I don't know.
But he answered when we got talking about the conversation of Josh Keyser being the one that done it. Abbott just looked at him and just kind of laughed a little bit, and he said, "Yeah, they got the wrong guy for that." He said, "I took care of that bitch."
Bill Farrell, Kevin Williams, and a whole bunch of other people were getting paychecks from a bullshit company called Morley Paving and
That letter, I called Sheriff Farrell myself. I said, "Well, would you like me to come down and, you know, talk to me about this?" He said, "No, there's no need." He said, "I don't need to hear anything from you. I've got my conviction. Case closed."
That was it?
That was it.
All right.
This podcast contains adult themes and language. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, I'm Bob Miller, host of The Lawless Files, and you're listening to a special bonus episode of the podcast. In just a minute, we're going to play the recording of an interview I recently did with Tom Beardsley. Just a note that you will be listening to an abbreviated version of this interview on this platform. To listen to the full interview, you'll need to be a paid supporter who has purchased the access pass at www.thelawlessfiles.com. But there is quite a bit here to sink your teeth into. But just a little background first. I talked to Beardsley a couple of years ago when I was in note-taking mode for the book I was hoping to write. So that was before I decided to pivot to a podcast. I didn't record that interview. You've heard me refer to Beardsley before. His initial interview of Mark Abbott was recorded and transcribed, and we have played a reenactment of that interview. Beardsley was the chief deputy under then-Sheriff Bill Farrell at the time of the Michelle Lawless murder. He was the first person called on the night of the murder, he was the first paid deputy to arrive on the scene, and he was the first person to interview Mark Abbott about what he saw when he pulled up to the car. When I interviewed Beardsley a couple of years ago by phone, he told me he was taken off the case before he got the chance to interview Mark Abbott a second time. Furthermore, in that interview, he said he believed Farrell intentionally looked away from Abbott as a suspect in this case. He told me in that phone interview he suspected it had to do with Farrell's relationship to Larry Abbott, Mark and Matt Abbott's father. He cited campaign contributions as a potential reason for Farrell to do a favor. He told me at the time he didn't believe Farrell was on Larry Abbott's payroll, but perhaps it was more of a tit-for-tat kind of favor. As we've demonstrated throughout this podcast, it appears that every effort was made to shield Mark Abbott as a suspect, since he had given so many different accounts of what happened. Abbott's explanations, including descriptions of who he saw at the crime scene, changed many times. Portions of his story didn't even make sense. When pressed on the matter by Josh Keyser's defense attorneys, Bill Farrell could only respond, "I don't know," when asked why Abbott was not polygraphed and why his blood was not drawn. So what you're about to hear is a follow-up interview with Beardsley about his role, or lack thereof, in the investigation of Michelle Lawless's murder. I'm your host, Bob Miller. You're listening to The Lawless Files.
When you were assigned as an investigator, was Mark Abbott a suspect in this killing?
No, sir, not at any time.
Neither Mark Abbott nor Matt Abbott were vampired or printed. Why was that not done?
I don't know. I don't know that they weren't. I don't know.
But he answered when we got to talking about the conversation of Josh Keesler being the one that done it. Abbott just looked at him and just kind of laughed a little bit, and he said, "Yeah, they got the wrong guy for that." He said, "I took care of that bitch."
Bill Farrell, Kevin Williams, and a whole bunch of other people were getting paychecks from a bullshit company called Morley Paying and
That letter, I called Sheriff Farrell myself. I said, "Well, would you like me to come down and, you know, talk to me about this?" He said, "No, there's no need." He said, "I don't need to hear anything from you. I've got my conviction. Case closed."
That was it?
That was it.
All right. First off, can you just introduce yourself, who you are, and what your role was back in 1992 when Michelle Lawless was murdered?
My name is Tom Beardsley. I was chief deputy for Sheriff Bill Farrell in Scott County during that period.
Okay, so I wanted to kind of go back in time even before then. Can you just tell us how you got in law enforcement, about what time that was, the training that you had back before all of this happened?
You know, I started with John Dennis in 76. It was the last 3 months of his term, and then, of course, Bill Farrell took over on January 1 of 77. And I started out as a dispatcher. As soon as Sheriff Farrell took over, there were just four of us deputies for the whole county, and we worked 12 hours on and 12 hours off, except if a call came in at night, the closest deputy got it. So it was kind of a skeleton crew, and there weren't any divisions. If you caught a crime, you worked it from the beginning to the end. And we didn't have uniforms back then, didn't have marked cars. It was, it was definitely rural law enforcement with limited capabilities. If you took a vacation, one of the other guys had to fill your slot during the time that you were off, so. We didn't take many vacations back then either.
That's a lot of area to cover for four people.
Yeah, it's I think it's 444 square miles in Scott County. They divided it up into four sections. The bisection was the northeast quadrant, you know, Scott City and Commerce and Benton North. But as things went on, I became chief deputy for Sheriff Farrell, and so my duties, in addition to taking calls in my area of the county, I was also an administrative person, kind of between the sheriff and the other deputies. And that's not always an easy task, to try to make peace between the levels of government there.
What point did you become chief deputy? Do you remember the year that happened, or?
It would have been. I went to the police academy in I believe it was 78 at the Highway Patrol Academy, and I did the two session course there, and sometime shortly after I finished that, I was made chief deputy.
So that would have been late 70s, early 80s?
It would have been early 80s.
Early 80s.
Yeah.
So you'd been, by the time the Michelle Lawless murder came around, you would have been chief deputy for 10 years or more.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me more a little bit about how... obviously you're a small department, and I know gradually it got bigger. What was the size of the department in 92? Do you remember when the murder happened? It seemed like it was probably bigger than it was when you came on.
It was slightly bigger.
Uh-huh.
Active people, not so much. We added some reserve officers to do night patrols. But as far as having somebody come in and work a night shift, that was typically a reserve officer that did that. And we had a pretty active reserve.
Okay, so you had just a handful of paid deputies and then several reserves who were more volunteer or, you know.
Right.
Okay. So tell me what was the, you know, back in the 80s, and leading up to this, how did you guys approach a big case, like a murder or, you know, some high-profile crime? What were the marching orders? How did you guys attack it? How did you guys approach it?
Typically, we the person that got the call, especially like if it was at night, it was the closest deputy that got the call. And they would go to the scene and see what they had. And after I became chief deputy, they would call me, and I would either tell them to or not to call Sheriff Farrell. Normally, we would call him and let him decide whether or not he wanted to come to the scene. He hated surprises. He didn't want to wind up at the Sandburg restaurant the next morning, and something had occurred overnight that he didn't know about. I know I left a lot of hide on his office door when that would occur. So typically he was well informed as to what was going on. And even if I had any doubt, I let him know. It was his decision whether he wanted to handle it himself or come to the scene or had instructions.
So you had a small department. I'm sure you don't have a homicide division.
Didn't have at that time. No.
Yeah. So you say, was it like all hands on deck, or was it, you know, like you say, that you just kind of waited for Bill to decide how to handle each case, or how did that?
No, normally the deputy, when he got there and saw what he had, he'd call in and let dispatch know. Normally, if, like I say, after I got to be chief deputy, they would call me, and I would have them call the sheriff, usually, so that he could make a decision if he wanted something in particular done. Normally, the deputy that caught the call would work it from beginning to end. And if he needed additional help, he would call somebody to come in and help him.
Okay. Well, I mean, that kind of makes sense, you know, beginning to end, so you know the history of it, and you can, you know, check things that have been said previously, things like that. How many murder cases had you worked prior to the Lawless murder?
I'd worked on several, but just mostly by myself. I worked two that went through to confession and conviction.
So you'd gone to the academy. You were chief deputy. You'd been chief deputy for 10 years by the time the Michelle Lawless murder happened. So can you take me back to that night? What you remember? Do you remember getting the call? You know, just take me through getting the call and then what you did, what you remember happening that night from your perspective.
Well, I got the call, and I'm not really sure what time it was. I know it was late. I mean, probably early morning, late. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it was right close to where I live, so I was there within a couple minutes. And when I arrived on the scene, Rick Waller was there, and I don't know if Roy was there or not. He may have been out cruising looking for
Roy was there with Rick, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, when I got there, I asked Rick what we had, because you don't just drive up to a crime scene, you park a little bit away from it because you don't want to run over anything or destroy any evidence. So I parked up behind his patrol car. And I asked him what we had. He says, we got a body in the car. And so I went up there and I saw that the driver's side window was about halfway down. And I put some rubber gloves on and I looked through the window and I could see a body laid over on the right side, sitting in the driver's seat, but the upper torso was laid over in the passenger seat. And I asked Rick if he'd check, see if she was alive. He said he did and he didn't think so. I said, well, is EMS on the way? And they said, yes. So I didn't really think it was a lot we could do for it until EMS got there anyway. So I didn't reach in and touch the body. I did open the door, and I'm seeing brass. Appeared to be 380 or 9mm brass. One piece was laying right in the door sill where it had apparently ejected out, hit the seat, and the brass had fallen down right on the door sill. So I just shut the door to make sure that nothing fell out. You know, it stayed there, and I left it there because I knew we were going to have to work his crime scene, and we had to photograph everything before we picked it up. And Rick drew my attention to the blood on the guardrail, and there was a pool of blood in front of the car. And so I'm trying to kind of walk wide around this car so I don't walk through anything. And Rick says, looks like something happened down here at the bottom of the hill. And I told him, I said, we're going to need more help with this. This is beyond what we can handle. And I don't remember if there was a trooper on scene by then or if we called one and he showed up by then. But I did talk to a trooper that night, and they asked, do you want our crime scene, folks? I said, yeah, please. This is way past what we can handle. And so he called the crime scene folks, and of course that didn't go over very well with Bill. So
yeah.
And he never missed an opportunity to tell me, you know, see, this is what happens when you call the highway patrol.
So Bill Farrell would have preferred that you had not.
He would rather have handled it in house.
Yeah, but you were saying that it's more than you can handle.
Way past.
Yeah.
I mean, we had multiple scenes where something had happened, you know, and we had the basic crime scene gathering stuff, bags, tape, and that kind of stuff, and stuff to make measurements and stuff. But this is a major league crime scene. And I'm fully convinced that had we not called them, we'd have missed a lot of stuff just because we didn't have the capability to capture it all.
So once the highway patrol is called in, they come in, they start gathering the evidence. What kinds of things did you do? I know you worked overnight that night.
Yeah. I just kind of observed what was going on, and I stayed pretty much close to the car there in case they had a question or anything. And I did go down at the bottom of the embankment there and take a look around down there. And there was some question about maybe somebody was hidden over in the mobile home sales lot. So several of us went over there and searched each one of those trailers that was unlocked. That's pretty much what I did. I let the crime team folks just do their thing because they were experts in it.
When did you find out that Mark Abbott had come in and reported the death? Do you remember?
Sometime when I was up on the hill. Rick may have told me that.
Okay, so I'm sure in your mind you're thinking we need to talk to this guy.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one of the first things I did the next morning. So I went to his residence in Scott City.
I remember reading the reports that you went there a couple of times. Do you remember when you went there and he wasn't there?
Yes, his vehicle wasn't there. We understood he drew a black truck, I think, mm-hmm. and it wasn't there. And I'm not really sure why, but Wes Drury was with me. When we went on the interview, and I don't know if he went just because he wanted to, or I know I didn't ask him to go because I normally work by myself.
Well, what happened was that Mark Abbott had come in that night, and he didn't retain him. And he reported his name as Matt. And then when Wes Drury made the phone call to Larry Abbott later to find out the address, he's like, oh, no, you're talking about Mark. And so what's been reported is that he went along with you to positively identify the twin as being the same person that he saw the night before.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that came up at trial, too, as best I remember, I was not called by the state. I was subpoenaed by the defense because of the things they hadn't annotated on my initial interview with him and all the lies that he told me. So,
yeah, tell me about that first interview. What do you remember from it? We've played reenactments of it on our podcast. But what were the things that stood out to you as maybe that there's something off here?
Well, of course, I'd been to interrogation and interview interrogation classes, and I knew to look for body language, that sort of thing. And he did exhibit some defensive things like crossing his legs and crossing his arms and that, you know, looking around rather than meeting eye contact. So it... His physical behavior was defensive in nature. Of course, you can't really blame a person, you know. I know I just notated that, but I didn't really write it down as a factor because I'd be nervous too if somebody's asked me if I killed somebody, mm-hmm. and I really never asked him that.
Right.
I asked for him to relate the facts to me as he recalled them. And I knew he was lying to me when he told me he reached in the car. So I started asking him questions to see if he'd lie to me again, and he kept on lying. And actually, I'm pretty sure he made some stuff up sitting right there on the couch in front of me. I don't know why he thought it was going to make a difference, but this fictitious person, he said, jumped out of the way of his vehicle. You know, there was no evidence of that. We were all over that crime scene that night on both ends of the ramp, and there was no evidence of anybody else having been there on foot or otherwise.
So in other words, you found no footprints?
No. Well, it was there wasn't any really muddy areas to leave a footprint. It was all grass, because Modat maintains that pretty well there. The only real disturbance to the scene was the blood and stuff over the on the guardrail. And then down at the bottom of the embankment, the grass was trampled down. But where he was talking about coming up the exit ramp there, there was no sign of any kind of footprints.
So the grass hadn't been pushed down?
No.
Stuff like that?
No.
Okay, so you go to his house. That's the Woodland trailer lot there that's owned by Reba and Larry. You don't see his truck. He's not there. You finally get there. He tells what you think, or like what you know. One of the first things you mentioned when you got to the scene was that window was about halfway down. And he said it was all the way down. And then you said you couldn't have reached in there.
I didn't confront him, I don't think.
Yeah.
He said that he did that. And I asked him how he did. He says, "Well, I just reached arms and shoulders inside," and I'm picturing in my mind, "Ain't no way he could have done that. I couldn't have done it, and I'm sure he couldn't have done it either." But that's what made me think I had a person that was not going to tell me the truth.
Yeah. He also told you about seeing rings on her fingers. Did that resonate with you at
no,
all?
No, because I didn't see the ring.
Yeah.
Her hands were under. So I never did see her hands that night.
Yeah. Okay, so you do the interview that you did only lasted 5 or 7 minutes, but you had already had enough information where you wanted to interview him again. What happened from that point?
Well, typically, if you interview somebody out in the field and you get a reason to re-interview that person, it's better to do it quickly. And so I told him, I said, since you were in the car, we're going to need you to go down to Benton and give us some fingerprints so we can eliminate your prints from whatever else we find in the car. And he said he would later that morning. And I told him that'd be fine. After we left trailer, Wes and I went down to the overpass there to see if there was any kind of evidence lending itself to the story he told about the guy jumping out of the way of his truck. And of course I didn't find anything, but I was just doing that as busy work until I was to come up and interview him again. And then I had called, I believe I talked to Brenda, and told her that I said, Abbott's coming in. I've already talked to him once, but I need to talk to him again because he's lied to me several times here. And that's a technique that you use with interrogation, is you interview somebody. If nothing throws up a red flag, then you'll probably come back and interview him later, but it's not a matter where time is of the essence. If a guy throws up a red flag by lying to you, and you're convinced he's lying to you, then you want to do that second interview pretty quick, and you want to do it on your turf. here I'm sitting in his living room, and he's feeling pretty comfortable there. Well, I wanted to turn that around, so I put him in a an interrogation room area at Scott County. And we didn't really have an interrogation room. We had a back office that we used.
Right.
This is back in the days of the house and the falling down jail. So anyway, I told Brent, I said, I need to talk to this guy. Don't let him go until I get another chance to talk to him. And I said, while we're waiting, I'm going to check his overpass on this story that he was telling me. And when I got done looking at this this scene, it was about time for him to be up there. So I went up to the office, and he had already apparently gotten there. And I don't remember who told me. It would very likely have been Brenda. She and I shared an office at that time. And anyway, I walked in there and I said, is Abbott here? Say, well, yeah, he's in with the sheriff and he's going to do the other interview. I said, really? Well, I got some information he needs to know before he does his interview, you know. And she said, well, he's already started. I said, I'm going in there to take notes. Okay.
We've reached the conclusion of this free bonus episode. To listen to the rest of the interview, including why this investigation bothered Beardsley so much he quit his job, please go to www.thelawlessfiles.com and purchase the access pass. Thank you for your support.